Okay. Kind of find it intriguing. I don't think, because there's no quiz today, it seems we're missing a few students today. But that's their choice. Okay, so we got all the way through to, and I might as well pull this out because it's all sort of drawn there. We got up to, but we didn't include, we did the facet joints and then we finished there, correct? The zygapophyseal joints. We did not get to the disc, correct? I kind of spoke a little bit, but I didn't really get to it. Right. Okay. So if we remember then, when we look at the anatomy, again, looking at the diagram here, anteriorly is the body, and then we have the processes posteriorly. And we already talked a little bit about this, these zygapophyseal joints. We have to remember we had these articular processes, both superior and inferior, sort of coming off the lamina as it relates to sort of where the it's where the lamina sort of lies and it's within it. And remember that the, you know, the superior articular process articulates with the inferior articular process of the level above it, correct? We could say conversely, the posterior articular process articulates with the superior articular process of the level below. Okay? So that's your posterior or your posterior joints. And remember that, you know, again, structure governs function. How they relate to each other will certainly influence how each of the spines move. And when we start getting into the individual spines, which of course today will be the C spine, you'll see how that relationship starts to work. Anteriorly, then on the body, we actually have an anterior vertebral joint, and this is where we find the intervertebral disc. Does anybody remember what kind of joint this is? So we have two bones with a fibrous disc in between. Yes, it is a symphysis. Okay? So, in so much as I will discuss the symphysis and use the example of the pubic symphysis in the anterior part of the pelvis, this too is also a symphysis. So that means that you've got two bones with articular cartilage with a fibrocartilaginous disc in between. Okay? And this is on the anterior aspect. So, they are secondary, oh, sorry, symphysis. And what happens is between C2 all the way down to S1, so we're talking the majority of the C spine, all of the T spine, all of the L spine up until the top of the sacrum, between every vertebral body there is a disc. And I think I've drawn this a couple of times for you where I just sort of quickly draw vertebra. Okay, and then between each one we have this disc sort of lying right in here. So between all of those from C2 to S1, there's a disc between every vertebral body anteriorly. Okay, remember it's anteriorly. There is no disc between the occiput and the atlas, nor between the atlas and the axis. The occiput and the atlas is those condyles on either side of the foramen magnum, so that's the occiput with C1. And then there's no disc between the articulation between C1 and C2. And then below C2 begins the first disc. The reason for that is because a disc somewhat limits movement, therefore range of motion. The articulation between the occiput and C1 and C1 and C2 is what allows for a lot of these, the significant head range of motion that we have in terms of flexion, extension, rotation, lateral, and so on and so forth, right? That's where a lot of that occurs. It unites the vertebra into a continuous semi-rigid column. So the fact that there's a disc between each one, it helps provide some rigidity to the spinal column within that, okay? So in so much as they are building blocks, sort of one on top of the other, these vertebral bodies, we do have this disc material between them. When we look at the height of the spine in general, these discs represent about a quarter of the height of what represents our total height. And it is through things like osteoporosis and the crumbling of the vertebral bodies, and also the loss of disc, because we all lose disc. All of us, no matter how hard we try and how much we work out and how great our posture is, the fact that we're on two legs, we still lose. So this is why grandma or grandpa are a little bit shorter than they used to be when they were younger. And they'll even say that to you, that they seem to have gotten shorter. That's because the discs do start to wear out, and that overall height of the body starts to come down. They are shock absorbers within this configuration. Now, within here, when we look at these vertebral bodies, because we have to remember, you know, when we did the drawing last week of the ship, the sail ship, and, you know, this representation of the majority of mass being anterior to the vertebral column, and everything kind of wanting to move forward and downward, we have to hold these vertebrae in place because they're, the potential for problem is there because, you know, again, you know, take Jenga, for example, what happens when you start removing support in those lower Jenga pieces? Eventually it will collapse. So we have to have holding elements here when we look at this relationship between the vertebral bodies and the entire spine. So the first is this disc. When you see IVD, it stands for intervertebral disc. Okay, that's what IVD stands for. And I did, I think, write this last week. You also have a ligament that runs anteriorly all the way down, anterior to the bodies themselves. This is known as the anterior longitudinal ligament, and we'll be coming back to that. And behind, in the back, so sort of running the posterior aspects of the, I'm going to do a bit crooked here because they don't quite line up, but that's okay. Posteriorly, we have the posterior longitudinal ligament, meaning longitudinal because they run the entire length of the spine. All right? I think you did do this last week, didn't I? And of course, the disc is designed for strength against weight bearing and shearing forces. So obviously, when we look at the disc, because we have larger vertebral bodies, as we work inferiorly, so too the disc gets larger because of the increasing weight that the disc has to hold in the dynamic movements that a human does at any given time, sitting, standing, running, whatever it may be. So let's look at this disc. It has some components to it. Okay? It has an outer part. This outer part is the annulus fibrosus. Annulus fibrosus. It looks like an onion. So think of, you know, when you peel layers of an onion, you have these layers that work their way in. So the annulus is fibrous tissue in layers, but there's a grain to it. How many people understand what grain is? Who here works with wood? Those sorts of things. So the grain is the lines that you see in the wood, right? There's a particular relationship to these grains. The same thing happens here. So we say it's composed of concentric lamellae of fibrocartilage forming the circumference of this disc. So we can say that, you know, within the context of this, we have these layers that constitute this disc in general. Okay? So got these layers. Now, the layers cross each other obliquely in opposite directions. So when we see here in the diagram, we can see the layers here. We can see the grain on the outer layer here sort of obliquely running inferior to superior. We can see here in the next layer in, the fibers are running superior to inferior in the opposite direction, and we'll get some moving. So they kind of crisscross each other in terms of fibers. Why would you see that? Yes. It provides strength. So by having one this way, one this way, one this way, one that way, you have to remember as well, these shearing forces means at any given time the disc is either having pressure downward, upward, to the left, to the right, to the back, to the front. And we need strength in those dynamic movements. Now, they're not moving hugely, but there is forces that are traveling in any one of those directions, anteriorly, posteriorly, laterally the direction, inferiorly or superiorly, depending on what's happening. So by placing these lines in concentric circles and then lining them up in such a way that these fibers run, as we say here, obliquely in opposite directions, it ensures that any direction of force is placed on the disc, it will be able to withstand those forces in any sort of dynamic movement. Again, it's not perfect, because I can tell you about my age, my lumbar discs are far thinner than yours, no matter what. That's just natural to aging. It's what happens, okay? This allows for limited rotation between adjacent vertebra and provides a strong bond. when we look at these curves, we say it's thinner posteriorly, okay? So it's a bit thinner, and only the outer third receives sensory information. So when we think of sensory, what's sensory? Nerves that represent what might be a sensory message?
Pain.
Pain, right. So we're saying that only one third sort of receives any sensory information. So that means any damage that may be occurring in here, if there's going to be damage, we won't feel that as such. But if the outer parts of this annulus fracture or tear, then we will feel discomfort. So how many people here already in your life have been doing something stupid, like lifting something heavy or whatever, and hurt, but had no pain? Anybody here? Little click, little pop, didn't feel any pain?
Really?
That's probably tearing one of your layers. Okay? Quite often you'll hear that from patients in clinical practice where, you know, they've got some back pain, and you'll say, you know, do you remember anything from the past? Like, did anything happen? Did you ever hear a click or a pop or have any pain or anything like that? They'll say, yeah, as a matter of fact, about 5 years ago, I was lifting a couch with my buddy, and I felt this pop, and I thought, oh, my God, what happened? And then they don't feel any pain. They think, oh, I'm okay. I'm good. So I'm going to keep going, okay? So it's the potential was that at some point that individual kind of tore a little bit of the annulus. As we said, we have these we have these two parts to it, you know, holding it together. So we've got these layers running around, and we can see here in the cadaver diagram, the cadaver photograph, this actually is a human disc. So you can see these layers of the disc itself, but you'll note that it's hollow in the center. In the center, it's kind of fleshy, kind of like a pudding, thick but wet. This is known as the nucleus pulposus. Okay, the nucleus pulposus. And this represents the core of the disc. Whenever I'm talking to patients when they have any kind of discal issues, I always try to describe the disc like a jelly donut. So you have the bread on the outside and you have the jelly in the middle. Right? So that sort of, patients tend to understand that. So same idea for you guys. It's like a jelly donut. You have this thick, fibrous outer layer and this fleshy, kind of wet middle in here. So, you know, it's kind of filling in the space here. Does anybody know fluid dynamics at all? How much resistance can water take? Yeah. If you put water in a container, strong container, and the water can't go anywhere and you push down on it, how much resistance do you think there is? A lot. A lot more than people recognize. Because we can dive in water, we don't think of water as being very resistant, right? Do a belly flop from about 30 feet and land flat on the water. It's as hard as concrete. That's how much resistance water actually has. So by placing something wet in here, you have the strength on the outside of these fibers, and then you have this fluid dynamic of being able to resist forces. It's very powerful, and it works well. So the semi-fluid nature is responsible for much of the flexibility and resilience to forces. So it allows that disc to be able to shift in rotations and movements, but at the same time, because it's wet, it provides a lot of shock absorption. And what happens is when the shock goes into that wet, fleshy area, the forces disperse, and the disc has a lot less stress on it, shall we say, okay? Pressure flattens and broadens the disc, and traction narrows and heightens the disc. Have you learned much about compression and traction? I don't think so yet, right? Compression, of course, you're all compressing your spines right now, right? You're sitting down, your upper body weight is pushing down on the spine, so you're compressing it. Traction is if I make the spinal column or the vertebra get farther away from each other. Right? So, for example, can I use you? Okay. So, I might have a patient who I'm potentially thinking about having a disc problem. If I push down on her head, what am I doing to the discs? Right? So, there's a potential she might go, ow, because I'm putting pressure on the disc in this semi-fluid area and the layers of the fibers and so forth. Conversely, if I take her head and I pull it up, What am I doing to the discs? I'm tractioning them and I'm making them farther apart. So what am I doing to the forces on the disc when I'm making them get farther apart? I am relieving them. So she says to me, hurts when you push, feels great when you pull. Then the potential is that there could be some reasons for that. And it could be disc is one of them, for example, where I'm putting pressure on this damaged disc, therefore it's not dispersing the forces, shall we say, and the patient goes, ow. Whereas when I put traction on it, she says, oh, that feels great because I'm taking forces off the disc. So it starts me thinking maybe there's a disc issue here. Yes. Well, within the soft tissue of the belly?
Yeah,
right. Right, but are you relating it just to the fetus and the uterus and the soft tissue in the belly here, or are you relating it to the spine? Yeah, I can take a little bit off the spine as well. Quite often, women will talk about how they like to go in the pool when they're pregnant because the buoyancy of the water takes, it almost becomes zero gravity and that whole weight, right? Either whether it's in the perineal area because of the pressure down on the vulva, or whether it's the spine or the soft tissues of the belly, they get in the pool, the fetus kind of floats in zero gravity, and they go, oh, feels good, right? So it's kind of the same idea. But you're going to go back to what I just said to you in terms of compression and traction when you're assessing patients for injuries that can possibly happen with disc and or. Because compression and traction also can irritate a facet joint. And we'll get back to that later, okay? By the way, how many people here, you get in the car in the morning, you got to adjust your rearview mirror because it seems to be off. And then you sit all day, and then you get back in the car and like, what the hell? The mirror's off again. Yes? You ever notice that? Why? Because when you were sleeping at night, your spine rehydrated and got longer. You got in the car, you're taller. You adjust the mirror. You sit all day, your body weight compresses the spine, and the water comes out of the disc. And when you go and sit down at night, you're now shorter, and you have to adjust the mirror again. Yes? Your spine is physically shorter. It's minor, right? In a healthy spine, it's extremely minor. But this is why the spine works so well, is because it's able to do this. This is what's required for normal function within those discs. Okay? And then when you get to be my age, all this stuff in the middle dries up, which is not part of the natural aging process. And what do you think is going to happen to my spine? I'm not going to have the same resiliency in terms of pressures and those sorts of things, because it's just a natural thing to occur that the nucleus pulposus actually becomes less hydrated and becomes dry. Yeah. Sorry?
The mirror stays low.
The mirror stays low. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I don't adjust it as much as you guys anymore. It's a good point, actually. So we can see here then, you know, here's the picture of the annulus on the outside and the nucleus pulposus here in the middle. This is a cross-section of a human vertebra. Again, you can see the layers, concentric layers of the fibrous tissue here, and then this gelatinous pudding-like nucleus pulposus in the middle that you can see. Okay? So we can see here in terms of proteoglycans. See, it comes back once in a while. Proteoglycans, because proteoglycans we're going to learn in clinical anatomy, or if you remember the lecture I talked about connective tissue, right? It hydrates tissues. So the amount of proteoglycans you have hydrates the disc. So we can see here the nucleus pulposus, it's about 77% water, and then the annulus fibrosus is about 70% water, and then the cartilage end plate is about 55% water. And we know with age that that all starts to lower and become less water as we get older. Okay. Now, I'll just give you a little sidebar here. How many people here have heard the term slip disc? Okay, it doesn't exist. Well, it does, but in a whole different context. The vast majority of people who have back pain with referring down the leg or numbness, tingling, those sorts of things, that is a herniation of the disc, not a slipped disc. So that little pop I talked about, right? So maybe now you've popped the disc. And you sit not so good, and the next layer kind of gets a little bit weaker. And then the lift again, you hear another pop a few years later, and you've done some problems there. And then like this gentleman I looked after many, many years ago, Ed was He was on the true team for the OPP. He was about 6'5", about 250, solid, solid muscle. I mean, I'm talking a man's man, like thick, muscular kind of guy. He's in the shopping. He's out shopping in the grocery store, and he needs some toilet paper, and he reaches down to pick up a package of toilet paper, and he stands up, and his leg goes numb, and he's bent over double, and he's got all this pain. He's like, what the heck? What happened was, this last layer gets very, very weak, and it takes a very minor movement, and then it goes. And what can happen is then the nucleus pulposus leaks out. And the problem with that is, right here, because remember, spinal cord's right here, correct? Okay? There's a nerve root that heads out to the body right there, and that leaking material pushes on that nerve root, and that's why you get distal discomfort down the leg or into the dermatomal pattern, which you'll learn, or numbness and tingling, or if it gets bad enough, you even lose reflex and you get muscle weakness. You can't even stand on the leg anymore. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. They're called McKenzie techniques. Boyle's Law. How many people here know Boyle's Law? Come on. Really? No physics, high school physics folks? Okay, Boyle's Law states, take a container. If you make the container larger, pressure goes down. And when you make the container smaller, pressure goes up. If there's fluid inside that container, or like kind of a hose, I make the container larger, the pressure is less in the container. Is outside the container, what direction will the water move? In. If I make the container smaller, pressure gets higher in the container and outside the container, what direction will the water go? Right. So what I want to do is make this container larger. Therefore, this is going to go that way. How do I do that? Extension. Extension opens up the vertebral. Remember, the vertebral bodies are anterior, right? Flexion makes them closer together. Extension makes vertebral bodies farther apart. By making them farther apart, I make the container larger, and this material heads back in. A year. You're going to ask me to fix it? You mean to fix it in doing those exercises? It's a year investment. It's about a year. Thereabouts. And then, of course, then on top of that, and it's joints, I have to make all the muscles across that joint stronger. So you've got all the muscles posteriorly, and this is where core plays a big role. Weak core, bad back. Strong core, good back. When I first started in physio, we believed it was all crunches. This is what may help the back, and it doesn't. It's the obliques and all the musculature in here and core work, like planks, those sorts of things. That's what prevents us and makes it better. Anyways, I'm digressing. Yes. You're just moving the facet joints and you're getting a bit of a mobilization in the facet joint, not the disc. And you shouldn't do it. Yeah. Never. There's only one way to crack the knuckles, and that's make them longer. This compresses the joint, shoves them together, and that crack quite often, think of a little fleck of the cartilage going, gone. Yeah, and the thing is, if, you know, because I got friends that, you know, right? Well, what happens is you have hypermobile joints, and every time you crack, you're just making it more hypermobile. So you can be fair to say that a hypermobile joint has a greater propensity for injury, right? If you go to a chiropractor for adjustments, what the chiropractor is adjusting is not the hypermobile joint, they're adjusting the hypomobile joint. So you just keep doing this all the time. You think you're solving a problem, you're not. You're actually creating one. So it becomes habit with people, right? They just don't think about it and they, whatever. Yeah. Yeah. They do it, but they just are able to isolate specific joints and mobilize them. And you'll learn all about that in semester 3 when you start, I talk about it a bit in the second half of the semester. Remember that question and bring it back, okay?
With the stimulus, yeah. Does that heal?
A little bit, yeah. So if you have some blood supply here, Well, and we're going to be doing healing and inflammation in the second half in AMP. You need blood supply in order to have healing occur, okay? When you're doing this, the potential is you're only going to be able to heal about one-third of the disc. This is why you need the muscles as strong as possible around it to remove it. But I have seen, I worked in physio for almost 10 years. I have seen at least 40 to 50 people who didn't have to have spinal surgery because they did these techniques and got that disc back in, and then through exercise and training were able to avoid having to go down that road. Because in the 90s when I worked in physio, it was somewhat common to see spinal surgery. Now you almost never see it. Well, what happens is the majority of people don't get any better. If anything, they get worse, right? There are some instances where it's an absolute requirement, depending on the pathology, but quite often it's not worth it. Motion equals lotion. That's the term that's used in physio. Motion equals lotion. Moving your body, exercising, maintaining flexibility, that's what prevents all this stuff. So we can see here then, so that's your discs. There's a bit of an unusual joint. It's not really a joint, but it's important to talk about. And I didn't ever have this in the slides until I myself, so I have a bad neck. Well, I have a bad back too. I do actually have disc herniations. I have this in at C4 and C6. Okay, so I do have some material that does push on from time to time on my nerve roots, and I used to get pain and numbness down my arm. But because as long as I maintain exercise, so you guys don't know this, but this morning I was up at 5:30. I do about 40 minutes on the elliptical every morning. I do about 40 minutes of stretching, yoga-ish kind of stuff, and some core work, and then I lift weights, and then I come to work. If I don't do that, I'm a cripple. What's the best way to put it? So I do those things because that's what keeps me, you guys wouldn't even know looking at me. Last year, trust me, if you saw me in the hallway, this is how I was walking around the hallway last year, right? Because I had pain down my leg. I still have numbness in my foot right now, but I'm functional because I keep moving. So when we look at this, and I have a very intimate knowledge of it, this joint, because of my neck, I went and saw a physio a couple of years ago, and she adjusted this joint. She called it the U-joint. And I knew about this joint, but I didn't think it was anything that would significantly result in discomfort or pain. And when she worked on, did some joint mobilizations on this joint, I changed my life. So I felt it was important to put it on the slide so you understood what it was and the possibility of this joint resulting in pain patterns in your patient. So keep this one in mind. Not everybody learns this, so you're going to find some of your teachers in clinic won't even know what you're talking about, simply because it's that new, I've introduced it. So when we look at the C-spine, when we look at the C-spine here, we can see that here's the vertebral body, and you can see that on either side there's a rise superiorly. Maybe you can see it a bit better in this diagram. You can see that the lateral edges of the vertebral body come up, almost like a saddle, and then the one above, the body above, fits in that saddle, so that you can see the rise on either side is kind of up towards the vertebral body there. Can you see that? Right? And if you have your C-spines with you, you'll see it quite obviously there. So that's the smallest ones in your bag. I've got one here. And you can see it right there. See how it comes up either side? So you want your tiny, tiny, tiny one. So it goes up either side like that. You can see the rise on either side of the vertebral body. Either side, you've got those, almost looks like a saddle, doesn't it, right? That's C2. That one right there. It doesn't look like the models are that great, but see it come up on either side? Here and here? No. See it right here on the body? There and there. See how it's just almost like a saddle? Yep, and the other side. Here. See how it raises up on either side of the vertebral body? That's the U-joint. They're called uncinate processes. That's why they're called U-joints. Okay? See it from there? Kind of, sort of. Okay, see it come up on either side laterally. Okay. There and there. Okay. Yours aren't quite that good. As you can see them there and there. Okay. Okay, so when we look at these are called, the reason I call them U joints, they develop between the unci of the cerebral vertebra C3 to C4, C3, C4 to C6, C7. They are known as uncinate processes. We'll learn a little bit more about them when we get to the C-spine. But they're basically called uncovertebral joints. These are, they're not a true joint, right? They're not synovial or fibrous. But because they come up and they sort of lay lateral to the body above, a bit lateral to the body above, they can get jammed up a little bit and they don't function well. And so they can cause pain patterns in your patient in C-spine. There are some techniques you can learn after graduation to move these. They're very small movements, but they're quite effective. So just keep this in your back pocket to think about, you know, someone's got some cervical pain. They don't seem to be getting better with it. It might be something to consider as being part of the problem. Yeah. Only in the C-spine. Only in the C-spine. Okay. So we said the holding elements, of course, are the IVD, the anterior and posterior longitudinal ligaments. So let's talk about those. And that's, of course, the blue ones that we see here on either side of the vertebral bodies. And the names kind of tell you exactly what they are. So the anterior longitudinal ligament will tell you that it runs long, for heaven's sakes. I don't think they're flat. It runs long from the C-spine all the way down to the sacrum, and it runs anterior to the vertebral body. Okay, so it extends from the base of the occiput to the sacrum. It inserts into the periostea of vertebral bodies and into the IVD anteriorly. What does that mean? It inserts into the periostea of the vertebral bodies. What is that? Remember, bone has a skin. Remember the periosteum? Okay. So vertebral bodies are bone, so they have a skin on the outside, periosteum. Okay. So the ligament attaches to that, and it also shares fibers anteriorly with the fibrous layer of the disc. Okay. It is very strong. It has a tensile strength of approximately 3,000 pounds per square inch. That's pretty strong, right? So it does help support the disc a little bit. What's its functions? It resists hyperextension. So what I want you to think about is that if this ligament was running along the anterior bodies, this is going to do what to it? So if it's running anteriorly on the bodies and I go into extension, what's happening to this ligament? That's right, it's getting longer. Correct. Okay, so it resists me from going too far back. It supports and reinforces the intervertebral disc anteriorly, which I just kind of said. And in the lumbar spine, it assists to resist the weight of the spine and its tendencies to slip toward the pelvic cavity. What kind of curve do we have in the lumbar spine? All right, so I draw the part of the sacrum here. We say that the vertebral bodies, I'm not going to draw the bodies, but the spine kind of goes like that, yes? You have your lordosis here, you have the curve. Because it curves anteriorly like this, gravity is pushing down like that. So what direction do the lower vertebra want to go? Down and right. They want to go down and forward. Okay, just naturally, just because we stand up on two legs. So the anterior longitudinal ligament helps prevent that from happening. Okay? So we can see it here running all the way down the front, from the base of the spine all the way down to the sacrum. We can see it here in the mid-sagittal cut. Here is the anterior longitudinal ligament here. You can see attaching to the periostea of the vertebra and the anterior part of the disc. Now, when I talked about this disc traveling anterior and downward, you can have something called a spondylolysis or a spondylolisthesis or a lolisthesis in general, and that is this. So you get anterior slippage of 5 on sacrum or 4 on 5, and you can see that it, you know, this is the normal configuration of lumbar spine in that curve that I'm talking about. But what can happen is this disc or this body can start to move anteriorly to the point where the pars interarticularis, so that point where the articular processes on the lamina actually fractures off because it gets so far anteriorly, and then you can get to a point where you get a minor fracture, which is spondylolisthesis, and then you can get a full slippage forward and complete lack of integrity, which is known as a spondylolisthesis. Okay? I just discovered I have this. Yeah, a year ago. My four slipped forward on five. Yeah, this has kept intact, so it's there, but it's not unstable. Lolisthesis, the pars articularis is where the two vertebrae articulate. Yeah, so no fractures on the one below, so you don't have any integrity between. Yeah, the one below as well, so you don't have any integrity between the two any longer. So you can see here's your articulation back here, but there's no integrity to the body. Okay, yes. Yeah, and it's kind of a lolisthesis is here, so it hasn't really moved forward, right? It's a bit significant here. You'll see it here, so you get a bit of a break here. So this is a spondylolisthesis. That's when it gets really bad. You get this anterior slippage here. You'll note in this diagram, you still have fairly good integrity between the sacrum and L5 here when you compare the two diagrams, but here you can see how it's moved entirely forward. The disc is forward, okay? I saw my MRI. My disc actually is in a forward and like a teardrop lies on top of L5, in the front of L5. It can be over time or it can happen quite quickly. For me, mine slipped forward, but not enough for surgery. So again, the reason why I work out every morning is to help you maintain. Hence the reason why my foot is numb every day and all that stuff. They can't do a whole lot for it. I get injections occasionally of anti-inflammatories. I get epidurals, and it helps me for 4 or 5 months. But it's not unstable enough for a surgical intervention. And what they'll do with the surgical intervention is they'll put a screw in the body of this vertebra, and then a screw here in the sacrum with a bar kind of between the two. And as they tighten the screws, the bar will pull the one back on the other. Fun. So, this condition presents in 2% of adults. It's the anterior forward slippage of a superior vertebral body and vertebra above. Most commonly occurs at L5. In my case, it's at L4. My L4 has slipped. Spondylolisthesis is the fracture of the pars interarticularis, which results in loss of continuity of the articulating process. And then eventually, the vertebra then travels forward, eventually placing pressure on the neural tissues. And that's when you get into a spondylolisthesis, right? Okay. So mine's not bad enough for surgery. I flip forward, and I do have some issue with neural tissue. That's the reason why I get leg numbness and pain, all those sorts of things. So we'll see. Maybe one day it'll be surgery. I hope not. All that working out I did for nothing. So that was the anterior. The posterior longitudinal ligament is the same. So the anterior ran in front of the vertebral bodies, shared with the periostea and the disc. The posterior extends from the occiput to the sacrum posterior to the vertebral bodies. In other words, this ligament is inside the neural canal. So right behind the posterior longitudinal ligament is actually the spinal cord, okay, into that space, into that vertebral foramen. It is densely attached to the annulus fibrosus and to the margins of the vertebral bodies. So when we compare the two, anterior and posterior, so anteriorly, if we just look at some vertebral bodies here, okay, the anterior longitudinal ligament is quite wide and runs anteriorly down the front of both, like so, okay? So the anterior longitudinal ligament runs like that. When we look at the posterior longitudinal ligament, so we'll do the same thing with vertebra on this side, And we'll put the disc in here. The difference between the two, so this is the ALL, and this is the PLL. The PLL looks a little bit different. It's a little narrower through the body, but then it expands out at the disc, like so. Like that. So it looks a little bit more like that as it runs through. So it expands at the disc but is narrow on the body, whereas the anterior longitudinal ligament is quite thick and wide all the way from top to bottom. Okay? So we say then that it is densely attached to the annulus fibrosus and to the margins of the vertebral bodies. Lateral expansions over the discs are thin, while the more central portions are thick. So this area here is quite thick, whereas this area here is quite thin. Just do circles just to make it a little bit look a little bit different. Okay? Thick over the body is a bit thin over the posterior disc. Because of this configuration with being weak here, that leaky disc that I talked about earlier with the nucleus pulposus coming out, it can become an issue. This is why that any kind of herniation of a disc always happens posteriorly, not anteriorly. Because anteriorly you have that nice, big, thick anterior longitudinal ligament. Things can't get out. But because the posterior longitudinal ligament is thinner posteriorly, if you get some of that leaking of the annulus of the nucleus pulposus, it is able to slip through and get to the neural tissue because it's so thin posteriorly. Okay? It is less massive than the anterior, therefore it's considered to be the weaker of the two, but it still has the same tensile strength of, what, 3,000 pounds per square inch. Pretty strong, okay? This functions to resist hyperflexion. So the anterior resists hyperextension, posterior resists hyperflexion. Because again, where extension elongates the ALL, flexion elongates the PLL. So you can see it here. We can see the expansions here over the discs in the PLL running like this. This is an actual cadaver look. Here's the ALL running anteriorly to the bodies, of course, here. And we can see the PLL running on the posterior aspects here because the processes have been removed. And we can see it running along the spinal column there. Another ligament that we find here runs from lamina to lamina. See if everybody remembers here with your medical terminology. Flavum, what does it mean? Anybody remember? Latin for yellow. So this is called ligamentum flavum, which means it's a ligament that looks yellow. And it does, anatomically. This ligament connects adjacent laminae from C2 to S1. It has the highest percentage of elastic fibers of any tissue in the body. And because it has such a high percentage of elastic tissues, of elastic fibers, this is what makes the ligament yellow. So ligamentum flavum just means the yellow ligament. And it runs from lamina to lamina, which we can see here. So lamina, so we've got, again, a sagittal cut. We can see the spinous process here in part of the body. From lamina to lamina and lamina to lamina, we find the ligamentum flavum. And we can see it here as well in the drawing. By the way, if you're ever looking for a good book to give you some really good drawings of anatomy, his name is Frank Netter. His books are phenomenal. His drawings are gorgeous. He actually is an artist who sat in on cadaver dissections and actually paints drawings. And he has some of the more obscure ligaments and that kind of stuff in his drawings. But the books are beautiful. You could almost cut and frame most of his drawings. They're that nicely done. So his name is Frank Netter. Okay. It protects the spinal cord from encroachment by soft tissues on flexion and extension. It does contribute some fibers to the capsule of the facet joints because it goes from lamina to lamina. The elastic fibers exert pull on all articular facet capsule, thereby preventing synovial lining from being painfully ripped on extension movements. So it does help the fibrous capsule from getting pulled apart. And because it pulls on the capsule, it does prevent the capsule also from getting pinched when the two pieces of the psychopophyseal joint are getting closer together. Yeah. So it would run, so if I were to do a real quick vertebra here, it's running here, going up or going down. So it's filling in that space right there. Okay. Intertransverse ligaments. These are rounded cords between the adjacent transverse processes. This helps prevent excessive lateral flexion either direction. It's most substantial in the lumbar spine. So we can see our interspinous ligaments are right here, right? Intertransverse ligaments are here on the tips, running from TVP to TVP. We also have interspinous ligaments. They connect adjacent spinous processes from root to apex of each process. So here is our ligamentum. Here's our vertebral bodies. Here's the spinal cord. Here is posterior, of course, longitudinal would be back here. Anterior longitudinal would be here. We've got our ligamentum flavum that's here between lamina to lamina. And then between the spinous processes, we have the interspinous ligament filling in the spot here between spinous process and pre-spinous process. So it connects adjacent spinous processes from root to apex of each one. It limits excessive range and flexion. It's very important for stability of the spinal column. But what really becomes specialized in this structure, it forms the majority of a ligament that runs from basically T1 to the occiput, called the nuchal ligament or the ligamentum nuchae. And it is right here. So you can see here's the occiput. Here's our spinous processes here. And we can see that this ligament goes all the way out to the EOP. External occipital protuberance. So in here, in your neck, so put your hand right at the midpoint and kind of push in relatively firmly. So right about here, push in relatively firmly and bring your chin to your chest and tell me what happens to the tissue there. It'll poke out and get firm against you. You're palpating the ligamentum nuchae and you're feeling it go into tension and flexion. All right? Have you palpated that one in class yet? Ligamentum nuchae? Yeah, you may have, yeah. Okay. So we've got a few here. So here's our anterior longitudinal ligament here. Here's our posterior longitudinal ligament. Here's our ligamentum flavum going from lamina to lamina, right? Here's our intertransverse ligament here, which eventually will go on to become the ligamentum nuchae. Now I have this here, because what, any horsey people here? Okay. What's that called? Or when we grab and pull it, it's known as the mane. What we call is the crest, right? So anybody else here with horses? So it's sick, right? You can grab it and moves either way. That's their ligamentum nuchae. Yeah, you can where they're, yeah, especially in English writing, right? Yeah. So this book, their ligamentum nuchae is pretty extensive because it holds their head up. Prevents her head from falling down towards the ground. So they have one as well, but you can see it here on either side running up the middle. The next one is called the supraspinous ligament, supra meaning on top. Okay. This ligament it's a strong fibrous cord that connects the tips of the spinous processes from C7 to L4 or L5. And from C7 to the external occipital protuberance, it does help form the ligamentum nuchae. So here is your ligamentum flavum here between the lamina. Here's your interspinous ligament here in red. And here's your supraspinous ligament in blue going from tip to tip to tip. I've already done that. Here's a nice little picture. You just get a sense of here's the disc. Here's your annulus fibrosus and your nucleus pulposus. Here's your neural tissues here so you can see how it's built together, and I've already done that and that. No, I have double here. This is a great picture that sort of shows the herniated disc pushing against the nerve root, and you can see the fibers that are you know, been damaged, and they're pushing on the nerve root, which results in those sorts of problems. Okay? All right. Now we can get special. Here we go. So pull out your cervical spine. How many vertebrae should you have in your C-spine? 7, correct. They'll be the tiniest ones. You'll be able to note those uncinate processes. You're also going to have find a couple that look like this. One has this large process sticking up that looks like a finger, and one is completely almost circular that looks like this. You want to include those as well. So the thing we have to remember, we have to go all the way back to what makes up a normal vertebra. We have a vertebral body. What else do we have? What are the 7 processes? Pedicles. What else? Articular processes and spinous processes. Okay. So we're going to talk now that we're getting into each spine. We're going to look at the particularities of what designates differences between the C-spine and the T-spine, the C-spine and the L-spine, and so forth. Remembering back, again, I know I say this exhaustively, structure governs function. So therefore, the way these relate to each other and the way they're made, the size of them, and so forth, determines, in the case of the cervical spine, the amount of range of motion that actually occurs between them that gives us our normal rotation, lateral flexion, flexion and extension that we see in this cervical spine. So the bodies, they're oval in shape, okay, ovoid in shape. The superior surface is concave from side to side and has lateral margins that project superiorly to articulate with the inferior lateral margins of the body above. We just went through this, and that is the uncinate processes. Those raises on either side of the superior aspect of the vertebral body, which we can see here. Coming up on either side on the body, this ovoid body, we see these two superior processes, and they are known as the uncinate processes. And the combination of the uncinate processes to the superior body above forms that U-joint that I talked about earlier. Okay? We can see it here in an X-ray. They're quite obvious. This is a nice, healthy C-spine. We have a nice space between them. If you don't know about looking at X-rays, hard tissues are white and soft tissues are black. Maybe new for some of you. So you can see that there is space between the 4th, 5th, and 6th vertebra. They don't touch each other. And that's telling you that that's the disc that lies in between them. And discs being soft tissue don't really show up well on an X-ray. You just see the ghostly spaces between them. But you can see there is a nice space in between here. So this is a good, healthy C-spine. 3 is pointing at the uncinate processes that we can see here on the superior aspect of C6. You can see them here on C5 as well and so forth, okay? The pedicles in the C-spine, they are short, and they pass outwards and backwards from the middle of the posterior lateral parts of the body to form the wall, posterior medial wall of the foramen transversarium. So let's have a look at your pedicles. You know, in most cases at this point, the drawing that's been done or I've done them has the pedicles heading straight back. These don't. If you look at them on your model, you'll see that they're at the sides and they go out this way. Okay? So I'm going to start drawing a C-spine. We said that we have somewhat of an ovoid body, and we're saying here, if we look at it, we see that the pedicles kind of come out here, off to the side, all right? They say that the pedicles pass outwards and backwards from the middle of the posterior lateral parts of the body to form the posterior medial wall of a hole called the foramen transversarium. So let's have a look at this. If you look at, again, your C vertebra, you'll see there's two holes in there on either side, correct? I wouldn't use that one for now. We'll go back to that one. Use one of the more, no, go down, yeah, one of those, just for now. So you'll see there's two holes in here, right? So take a look at the pedicles coming on either side, and you'll see that they're back here. They sort of, if I put a little bit of a curve on it, it kind of does this, okay? And it's forming that back part here. So we can see that it's forming that posterior medial wall of the, what eventually will become this foramen transversarium. So here is your body here, ovoid in nature, right? We've got our uncinate processes here and here. Funny, this is called the joints of Lushka. Never heard that term before in my life. I've never even noticed that on the slide before. So disregard that. We'll just call them the uncinate processes and the U-joints, okay? And we can see that here is our pedicles here and here. And you can see how they're starting to form this posterior medial wall of this foramen transversarium, which we'll get back to. The laminae are long and rectangular and almost overlap their neighbors in extension. So you see that the lamina travel down this way. They don't go straight back. They travel down this way here. So we can see, again, here's our pedicles, and our lamina are here. And we can see that they're downwards and posteriorly this way. So posterior-inferior configuration, almost lying over top of their neighbor below. So if you stack a couple on top of each other, you'll see how they kind of relate. All right? Backwards and downwards, and they are long and rectangular and almost overlap. The spinous processes, of course, straight at the back, should have a little flare on either side. So you can see it's not a solid tip. There's actually two parts to the tip, and this is said to be bifid. So it has separation, shall we say, two fingers kind of sticking out. This is for muscular attachment. Of course, if we look, you know, we place this vertebra sort of facing you, we know that the body's anterior and the spinous process is posterior. Then the one extension on the spinous process is on the left would be attachment for the left side muscles. And the one on the right, of course, would be for the attachment of the right sided muscles. Because what's running right up the middle? Ligamentum nuchae. Right? It's running up the middle, so we have to have a tip going to one side for muscle attachments and a tip going the other side for muscle attachments. So far, so good? Ligamentum nuchae. The articular facets. They lay at the junction of the pedicle and the lamina on each side. Now, this is where, again, we go into structure governs function. The superior facet faces superiorly and posteriorly, and the inferior facet faces inferiorly and anteriorly. Yes, so the superior facet, the one on the top, faces up and back. All right, so this is the anterior over here, this is the posterior over here. So this vertebra, the superior faces this way, right? Upwards and backwards. The level above, its inferior process, faces down and anteriorly, like this. So this is the superior one facing like this. This is the inferior one facing like this. So they're on an angle to each other. Which you can see here, right? I thought I had a better picture than that. Let's see if I can find one here. You can see, here we go. So again, let's go back again, right? Superior faces up and back. Inferior faces down and forwards. So we go back here. Oh, I'm going the wrong way, sorry. Superior upwards, superiorly and posteriorly, this way. inferior faces downwards and anteriorly. Everybody can see that on your models? I bet you some of you wish now you bought a skeleton. These are little stuff that's really hard to stand up here and kind of show it to everybody. Does everybody see that? Do you see the articulation relationship? Okay? Basically, they're like this, right? All right? So, what's that got to do with the price of milk? This allows for considerable rotation between the vertebra. So the fact that they're oriented this way is what gives us or contributes to the amount of rotation that can occur in the cervical spine. Okay, this configuration allows for that. Now, this vertebral foramen is large and triangular. So you can see, for the size of the vertebral body and the processes, this vertebral foramen is pretty large. It's quite large. Right? Allows the nerve, this is where the neural tissue goes through. This is where my finger is, right? It's large and triangular. The transverse processes, each is short and perforated by this foramen transversarium. Basically, what that term is telling you, it is a hole in the transverse process. Anterior to the foramen, the costal process projects laterally to end in the anterior tubercle. So we can see here, we've got, this is the anterior part. So here's our body with our uncinate processes. Here's our pedicles representing this posterior medial aspect of the foramen transversarium. We have our two articulating processes, superior faces what and what? Superior and posteriorly, okay? Here are our two lamina here, and then our spinous process with the bifid tip. So our transverse process is right here. We say anterior to the foramen, the costal process projects laterally to end in the anterior tubercle. So we have this anterior tubercle right here. And you can see it on your own model. In this case, it's kind of broken off of this one a little bit, but there is a tubercle anteriorly. Behind the foramen, the transverse process projects laterally from the junction of the pedicle and the lamina to end in the posterior tubercle. So here we've got, here we've got our pedicle here. We can see this part of the transverse process is anterior to the foramen transversarium. Here's our anterior tubercle here. And then the rest of the transverse process is behind, runs off of the pedicle that we can see here, and makes up that posterior lateral aspect of the rest of the foramen transversarium to form the posterior tubercle. You got one right in front of you. Here's what you need to know as well. The anterior tubercles for attachment for sclerenus anterior and longus capitis, and the posterior tubercle is the attachment for sclerenus medius and levator scapula. This is how particular we're going to get with musculature. Why? Because you can palpate these. I can palpate anterior and posterior tubercles. See, you probably heard the rumor that Brian's pretty deep when he works, right? You heard that? I heard people. You heard that before? Okay. Yeah. It's not that I work deep. I work specific. So if I were to go into your cervical area and you were having some issues, I would actually go into these individual attachments on either the anterior or posterior tubercles because that's where I tend to find trigger points. This is why it's so important to get this nitpicky in terms of your attachments because I will work through these tubercles as I work down to provide relief. Okay? And you will be able to palpate these. to some degree. Will you be able to individualize musculature that attached to these? Absolutely not. But if you can get into each level of the anterior or posterior tubercle and get in there and do some techniques, you could elicit trigger points, headache patterns, all those sorts of things. And that's where I spend a lot of my time. That's where I used to do a lot of my work. Right? So this is why it's so important to understand them. So let's draw here a bit, shall we? So we can see here that we had our pedicles here, right? And we're going to come, so this is anterior and posterior. So we've got this the pedicle here coming back, right? Then we have, coming off the tip here, we've got this small sort of narrow transverse process here, right, that's going to come into the anterior tubercle, and then coming off here, off of the backside here, because this is where we're going to find our articular process here, we have another part here that sort of thickens up, and it provides the posterior tubercle. So we have our foramen transversarium here, right? Remember, this is anterior, correct? We have the anterior tubercle here and the posterior tubercle here. And, of course, then we have our lamina coming off of here. And then we have our spinous process coming accordingly. I know it's off, but just gives you the idea where it is. Does everybody understand that? So here's your pedicle. This is basically your TVP and built. So we said the pedicle is the posterior medial aspect of the foramen transversarium. The anterior tubercle part here, this represents this anterior part of the foramen transversarium. And then the TVP here that makes up the posterior tubercle fills out the rest of the foramen transversarium. Yes? Kind of, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's why it's called the foramen transversarium, because ultimately this is the TVP. This is your pedicle. So cut across here, this is your TVP right here. Does that make more sense now? Okay. How's that? God, Brian, we have to do glucose metabolism first. Now we're doing this. Any questions? Okay. And you do need to know those muscle attachments. The foramen transversarium. So what the hell is it there for? Like, why even have it? Because two vessels run through here. We have an artery. And in some cases, we have a vein. So if you stack up all your cervical vertebra from top to bottom, you'll see that that is the foramen that runs all the way up either side, running up the side of the vertebra. So the foramen transversarium transmits the vertebral artery and the vertebral vein. We're going to learn here shortly, this vertebral artery starts at C7, works its way all the way up to C1, C2, winds its way around, does a little loop-de-loop and goes right up the foramen magnum and supplies the base of the brain. So this small artery that runs through this foramen transversarium works its way all the way to the base of the brain and is one of the vessels that feeds a particular anastomosis, which may be new to some of you but not to others, known as the circle of Willis. How many people have heard that before? Right? So that's where this is one of the vessels that feeds the circle of Willis, along with the internal carotids. Yes? That little hole, correct. So we'll look here in the diagram. What did I have here? What's that there for? I don't remember what's on this one. Oh, I'm not going to worry about that. I used to do that, and it just complicated things. I found students got complicated with it, so I don't do that anymore. Okay. You can have a look at it. It just shows the interaction of the vertebra and flexion and extension, so you get a sense of how they work. with each other. So why know all this stuff? First is, we spend a lot of time in the back. A lot of people have neck problems and headaches. So you have to start understanding the relationship of movements between vertebrae and how they work together, and knowing this anatomy and this relationship of the articular processes and the movements that occur is vitally important to understanding how you can, shall we say, problem solve when someone comes to you with issues. So we have to understand that this configuration of up and back and down and front and their relationship to each other, the way they stack up, is why they're able to do the movements they do. We also have these uncinate processes to think about. And on top of that, then, of course, we have these anterior and posterior tubercles. There's a bit of a split to the TVP with different muscles that attach to the posterior tubercle and different muscles that attach to the anterior tubercle and then their relationship to it. We have to remember that in some cases, muscles go up and we'll have four attachments onto four different tubercles on four different levels. So we can say a muscle has attachments from C1 to C5 or C4. And so therefore, it's telling you on the anterior tubercle. So we might say a muscle has its proximal attachment to the anterior tubercles of C2 to C5. So that's telling you that that muscle, as it heads towards that cervical attachment, there's three separate attachment points for that muscle on the anterior tubercles. And that's why Brian comes along and rubs that anterior tubercle to see if there's any issues. Okay, everybody follow that? Other ones will, of course, attach to posterior tubercles and so on and so forth. Okay? All right. Let's get to the funky ones. So please pull out your circular one and your one with a finger on top. I did say previously that there is no articular disc between C1 and the occiput and C1 and C2. The circular one is C1. So this is the one that articulates with those condyles on either side of the foramen magnum of the occipital bone. The one with the finger sticking up is C2. So they articulate, where are we here? Like so. So you put one on top of the other. Here we go. And you'll see there's no disc in between. They fit quite nicely. They articulate directly with each other with no disc, okay? So let's talk about them. C1 is also called the atlas. Who was Atlas? I don't think they teach this stuff anymore in school. Yes. Greeks thought that Atlas held up the world. Okay? So because we have this melon that sits on top of C1, it's called the atlas because it holds up the head, I guess. Okay? It has no body or spinous process. So if you've done some palpation of C-spine in lab, you should have been told, and I know you have, that the first spinous process you palpate is C2, correct? Because C1 doesn't have one. And when you look at it, you can see that, yes, there is not one. There is no spinous process to C1. It consists of two lateral masses united by an anterior and posterior arch. So, again, giving us that circle, we have these two lateral masses on either side. We have an anterior arch and we have a posterior arch, right? And they were, you know, when created, this is where we would find the spinous process in the vertebral body, but of course C1 doesn't have them. So two lateral masses and two arches, anterior and posterior. The laminae form the posterior arch, which are grooved on the superior surface behind the lateral mass for passage of the vertebral artery between the atlas and the skull. Here was the problem that needed to be solved. And I'm going to grab something I have for this. An artery. So, I am going to take C1 here. And we know that there's foramen transverse area on all C-spine, correct? Okay, so we're just going to do C1 for now. So the artery has, of course, been coming up from the lower. It's pretty cold in here all of a sudden, eh? I think it's freezing in here right now. So the artery is coming up through the foramen transversarium of the ones below. Now the occiput sits on here. I have to solve a problem. I've got to get an artery to the brain, but I have to do it in such a way that there's no chance that that articulation between the occiput and C1 will pinch that artery, right? So how do I do that? I do it by fo as follows. The artery comes up through the foramen transversarium and wraps around the lateral mass. So then go up to the brain. Crazy, eh? I will, I will. You can see it goes. Just want to get my finger here so I don't lose it. It goes up and around underneath the mass. So the skull's going to sit on top here, and by the skull sitting on top, then of course the arteries running underneath this lateral mass, it's not going to get pinched. See it? Okay, runs all the way up and around so that it does not get pinched. So the skull would sit on top here. So by passing underneath that, and then it makes a sharp turn superiorly there to feed the brain. Remember, that's coming from below. Comes through, around, wraps around that mass, and then goes up into the brain.
Okay.
So the occiput sitting on top, there's no way it can get pinched underneath. Because the condyles of the occiput sit right on there.
Yeah. Okay.
So that way, by wrapping around underneath, I mean, this is a bit thick, so it does stick out a bit, but it's a bit thinner artery, but it does pass around underneath and then goes up into the circle of Willis back like that.
Can I just compare the okay, have that to mine?
So it would come up
yep.
and then around back here. See, this is the anterior.
Yep.
This is the posterior. So the artery is going to come up and go around that pillar and then come in. Okay. Now it is amazing. Okay. That's coming from below. So in your case, it will come, where are we here? That goes this way. That's superior, this side here. So the artery would come up through here and then go around here and then up into the brain. Yep.
Those aren't the TVPs, right?
This is the superior articulating process that the two condyles on either side of the foramen magnum sit on.
Okay.
Those occipital condyles?
Yeah.
They sit right on that. Okay.
I do have it. I feel like it built my spine. This is
that's superior. Yeah. Yeah, but we'll talk about that. You'll know how to differentiate between the two.
Okay.
Nope. Other way around. That's superior. It's just like that. Like that. Just like that. You want to see it or not? Okay. So back in the day when I used to teach about this artery, there was news articles that were circulating or had for a couple of times. How many people have heard the accusation that high cervical spine adjustments from chiropractors could result in stroke? Do you remember that? What's that?
This is lateral
mass
and this is lateral
mass? They're both lateral masses.
Right.
Two lateral masses, anterior and posterior.
Okay, so here.
That's correct. That's a correct arrangement, yep. So there was some thoughts, and I'm not going to lay judgment. I'm not going to say one way or the other. But, again, we have to do another loop-de-loop here to get into C2, right? So some felt that high cervical adjustments, if there was a genetic predisposition to a weakened layer of the vertebral artery, that an adjustment could tear that layer, which could result in the formation of a clot. And as I said, it feeds the base of the brain, that there could be a resultant stroke after an adjustment. It's been to court a few times. Nothing's ever really been proven as far as I know. I've met people who said that they know somebody who they're for sure likely got a stroke from a chiropractor, but as I said, I'm not going to stand here and accuse one way or the other. I'm just letting you know that this configuration is why it's the reason why it's suggested that it may be a cause, and leave it to the courts to decide if it is or not. Now, you are going to learn in assessments class a test to do to see if there is an issue with the vertebral artery. And you place your patient in a particular position and move their head accordingly. And if the vertebral artery has a bit of a problem, you, in fact, can pinch it off, and lower blood supply to the brain, and the patient will experience vertigo. You'll see the eyes start to go, those sorts of things, which means no high cervical joint mobilizations, that kind of stuff. Sorry, somebody had a question? I saw a hand up. No? Okay. All right. So follow that around. So the lamina from the posterior arch, which are grooved on the superior surface behind the lateral mass for passage of the vertebral artery between the atlas and the skull. The spine is replaced by the posterior tubercle, right? So we said the lamina form the posterior arch, and then the spine was replaced by the posterior tubercle. Therefore, we say the posterior part is unpalpable because it's too far forward, too much tissue to get through there, and the ligamentum nuchae to kind of get at there. The superior and inferior facets lie on the lateral masses. And here's how someone was asking earlier. The superior facet is concave and kidney-shaped to receive the occipital condyles, and the inferior facet is almost circular, slightly concave, and faces downwards, right? Which allows for retraction and protraction of the head. So basically, the two articulations between the two are where we're able to either do this, right, or this. Okay? There is an inward tubercle from each lateral mass that gives rise for an attachment for something called the transverse ligament. So I'm going to place this string sort of here as best I can, and that represents where you would find this transverse ligament running across from the two masses immediately here. So we're saying there's an inward tubercle from each lateral mass that gives rise to the attachment of the transverse ligament, which is what I've got the string kind of running across. Okay. Now, if I do this properly and I put C2 in here, this lateral ligament, try to do this without doing too much here. It's kind of hard to do with one hand. Suffice to say that that lateral ligament holds the part of C2 in. So it runs across right here. Okay? So this would be your superior articulating surface here, circular inferior. So an inward tubercle from each lateral mass gives attachment to the TVP, the transverse ligament. This ligament divides the space into a small compartment and a large compartment. The small compartment is the anterior compartment, which holds the dens, which is this extension on C2. The larger posterior compartment is where we find the medulla oblongata and its coverings as it's passing down to eventually become the spinal cord. Okay? So a well-placed stab wound between the occiput and C1 will instantly kill somebody, because you'll drive it right into their medulla. So this space here, so this would be sitting on the occiput. So you literally would slide a sharp instrument right along the base of the occiput into this area. Actually, it's kind of one of those famous assassination techniques that were used with ninjas. If you were sleeping, they'd slide a very thin needle in and pass through the base of the skull, go into the medulla and kind of wiggle it back and forth, destroying the neural tissue, pulling it out. Really no blood, no signs of anything, and the individual would die because you destroy your respiratory centers here and their cardiac centers, so the heart stops, they stop breathing, and then they would die. Yeah. Good to know. The transverse tubercle lacks an anterior tubercle. On the posterior surface of the anterior tubercle is an articular facet for the dens of C2. So if you look at, again, your ring here, so the large ring is posterior and the small ring is anterior. If you look on the posterior surface of the anterior ring, you'll see a smooth surface on the inside. Do you see that? Okay. That would be covered in hyaline cartilage, which would allow the odontoid process or the dens of C2 to fit in quite nicely. Because we're going to discover it is the articulation of 1 and 2 that allows us to go, no. So that's occurring here. So we have articulation of the dens here on its flat surface with the flat surface inside the anterior ring of C2, which provides rotation. Oops, I got it backwards. There we go. So we can see here, there's a flat surface here, number 3, for articulation of the odontoid process of 2. Here's the anterior ring here, anterior tubercle. Here's the posterior here, posterior tubercle. Here's a superior articulating process here, foramen transversarium, and transverse process here and here. Have you guys palpated C1 yet in lab? Bet you haven't. Some of you have done it. What's that? No, C1. Sure can. You can palpate the TV, not the spinous process, transverse process of C1. You can palpate. Did you do that? Are you sure? Did your partner at the time say, oh my God, that really hurts? No. Were you taught to rotate the head contralaterally? Who wants to come up and volunteer for a minute? It's not going to hurt. Somebody new. Come on. There's all these people who haven't come up yet. I'll pick somebody. Come on. So how were you taught to palpate C1? What was your landmark? Right. So you're... Come this way just a bit. There's a bit of a chair right here. Okay. So you've palpated the mastoid process, correct? Okay. So the mastoid process is where you'd like to be. So however you get to the mastoid process is up to you as far as that goes, okay? So we've got the mastoid process and we have the angle of the mandible where my two fingers are, right? Anatomically, C1 lies inferoanteriorly to the mastoid process, okay? So I'm going to come down the mastoid process and have you rotate away from my finger. And there's C1 right there. Yeah. Hurts, doesn't it? Move just a bit more. Yeah, right there. Okay, so stay there for a minute. Then come to the other side. Okay, we're going to find out here. Okay. So she is like this. So the right side's up a little bit and anterior. Thanks. Yeah. See, were you palpated there before? Were you? Did you think your partner found it? It's a lot more anterior than you think. It almost lies behind the point of the angle and the ramus of the mandible. Right. So find that mastoid process. Now I'm pretty easy. Mine are right here. They're quite accessible. But you got to get in behind that mandible. Why? Because you got attachments there, and probably where you're holding your head, you have a bit of anterior carriage, right? If you want, come up. I'll find yours, and they'll know where it is. Okay. All right. Let's take a break. I'll see you guys top of the hour. We should be good now, and we are. Okay. Let's continue where we left off. So, we already did C1. So, just one, again, we see here, we see the diagram here as well, the relationship between the atlas and the axis here that'll come together. We can see here, this explains quite well. There's your lateral masses, there's your anterior tubercle, your anterior arch, there's your posterior arch with your posterior tubercle. This represents your superior articulating facets. Same thing here, and then of course your TVPs come off the lateral masses either way, and of course then you have the foramen transversarium that transmits vessels. We can see them here as well. These pictures just help you sort of putting things together. So we did C1, the circle, the ring. Now we're going to do the one that has the big piece that sticks up superiorly, which is C2, known as the axis. The atlas, of course, is called the atlas because it holds up the head. The axis, C2, is called the axis because without odontoid process, C1 spins around that odontoid process. So therefore, because it's rotation, it's known as the axis. On the superior surface is this dens or odontoid process. Odontoid process basically stands for a tooth-like process, is what that means. Either name you can use, I'll use as well. We already talked about that transverse ligament that runs within the two lateral masses with two tubercles on either side. Remember we said that the transverse ligament divided it into a small anterior compartment and a large anterior compartment, or posterior compartment of C2. The dens fits into, so if I go this way, you'll see it better. So if the transverse ligament is sort of where my finger is, the dens fits in that anterior compartment, right, held in place on its posterior aspect by that transverse ligament. We say it's held against the anterior arch of C1 by the transverse ligament. Each thick pedicle is covered by the superior articular facet, which overlies the foramen transversarium. Now, what did we say the facet orientation was in the C-spine? What did we say the orientation was between the articular processes of the C-spine? The inferior one went down and anteriorly, and the superior one went up and posteriorly. So C2 is a transition. We have this large articular surface on either side of the odontoid process superiorly, where the inferior part of C1 articulates with the superior part of C2. When we look on the inferior part of C2, we are now back, we're now starting our normal configuration of articulation. So we have an inferior articulating process on C2, which faces downwards and forwards. Okay, so it starts. So the superior articulating part of C2 is different from the rest of the cervical spine. And of course, both the superior and the inferior articulating parts of C1 are irregular as well. They don't fit in that downward, forward, upward, backwards configuration. But again, remember, the fact that there's no disc here and the way they are associated with each other allows for this vast range of motion of rotation and slide glide. So it makes sense, right? So rotation occurs between C1 and C2, and protraction retraction occurs in the articulation between the occipital condyles and the superior articulating surfaces of C1. So this is between occiput and C1. This is between C1 and C2. Okay, that's C1 on the occiput, and rotation is C1, C2. Each thick pedicle is covered by the superior articulating facet, and again, we have, again, if I use the string here, we'd have to come, again, underneath this superior articulating process to get up to the foramen transversarium of C1 to head into the brain. The inferior facet, I said, is C2 is typical. The laminae here are thick for muscle attachments. TVPs do not have an anterior tubercle. So C2 to C7 have an anterior and posterior tubercle. C1 just has a transverse process, and C2 just has a posterior tubercle. I will repeat, C2 to C7 have both an anterior and a posterior tubercle. C1 only has a TVP with no tubercles, and C2 has just a posterior tubercle. Okay? Spinous process of C2 can be bifid in this particular specimen. This individual did have a bifid C2. So, again, as you learned in lab, your first spinous process palpation is always C2 because C1 does not have one. So we can see it here. or superior articulating surfaces here for the inferior part of the C1. And underneath, of course, is getting back to that normal configuration of the rest of the C-spine. Here we can see the transverse ligament on C1, which is what we're looking at. We're looking at the superior surface of C1. And we've cut away the top of the dens here, and you see how it fits in here with the transverse ligament holding it in place. Blue represents hyaline cartilage. So the posterior articulation between the transverse ligament and the dens and the posterior part of the anterior arch and the anterior surface of the dens, both of these form synovial joints. So you've got articular cartilage and a synovial membrane and the synovial space. And you can see that in the diagram. C7 is the last kind of weird one out. C7 is the last or the most inferior cervical vertebra, and it represents a transition of leaving C-spine and becoming T-spine, okay? So it carries characteristics of both. It will have its superior surface more related to the C-spine than, of course, its inferior surface would be more related to the T-spine. It's transitioning, right? But it will still carry some of its, some of those influences throughout. I have one here somewhere. I just don't know where it is. Here we go. You can see this is the spinous process. This is T2. T1 is more straight out, okay? But you can see you're getting more into a traditional spinous process in the T-spine. So when we talk about C7, we're saying basically that the spinous process is long, it is non-bifib, and it's completely horizontal. It sticks straight back, which we can see here, comes straight back. The TVP lacks an anterior tubercle. The foramen transversarium generally only transmits the vein. Quite often, though, there's no foramen transversarium in 7. I have one in there, but I'll have to dig around for it. So generally, it can have a foramen transversarium. It may not. That's that right there. You are correct. So this is the one that you have in your model if you have the spine there. It's kind of like that. It's got a straight back spinous process, and they did put foramen transversarium in this one. If there is one, only the vein runs here. The artery's already left, or not left, it's coming. Sorry, if I say it appropriately, because the blood's coming to the area. So we can see here, we've got C1 here, which is going to articulate with the occiput. We have C2 here with the dens, with the articulation there, and their specialized articulation here. And then we start C2 all the way down to C6. We have that association of the articular processes. We have the bifid spinous processes. We have the anterior posterior tubercles on C3, 4, 5, and 6. And then C7 starts to differentiate, looking a little bit more like a thoracic vertebra. This is showing you how the art of the vessels work. So we can see here on the left, here you've got your subclavian artery here, and you've got your common carotid here, which will split into your external and internal carotid. So this is the external here, here's the internal. And not the subclavian artery, we have a branch here that becomes the vertebral artery. We can see it passing through the foramen transversarium here, doing the loop-de-loop to get into the base of the brain to feed the base of the brain. On the right-hand side, we can see the venous returning of blood from the brain, traveling again down through the foramen magnum, and then passing through, again doing a bit of a loop-de-loop, passing through the foramen transversarium to get all the way down into the subclavian vein and then eventually into the heart. Okay? Yes? Both of them, except C7, usually only, if there is one in C7, it only carries the vein, not the artery. The artery usually enters in about C6. Make sense now? You see the picture? Okay. The hyoid bone, we've already talked about a little bit. It's in the anterior neck. It is very mobile. It lies at level of C3 between the mandible and the thyroid cartilage. So, again, I think I mentioned this in class the other day. You got to think of that mandible and that thyroid cartilage, and you have to get above that thyroid cartilage to get to the hyoid bone. It's a lot higher up than most of us realize when you first start palpating. It lies suspended by the muscles that attach to it, both superiorly and inferiorly, which we've already done. It's connected to the mandible, thyroid cartilage, and manubrium and scapula through all these muscles. It is U-shaped, which we've talked about already. There's no articulation with any other bones. It's relatively free-floating in the anterior neck. And the middle part of the U faces anteriorly, which we can see here. Again, we can see that we've got our cornu here. The body is the central part. We have the two that head superiorly up as the smaller horn, and then the two that come posteriorly back to make up the U. These are the larger cornu or horn that we see here. And we've already done the muscle attachments. You can see here, again, the thyroid cartilage is always very easy to palpate because of the way it sticks out the anterior neck. But you can see that the hyoid bone is considerably anatomically higher than that thyroid cartilage. So, of course, your landmark easily could be the thyroid cartilage, and then up you go. Okay? All right. So, as usual, we've done the bones. Now we need to do some ligaments. So we've got a lot of movement here in these articulations between the cervical vertebra, C1, C2, C1, and the occiput. So we had to allow for a considerable amount of range of motion, but we also have to provide stability. So we have to talk about these unique articulations between some of these specialized ones. So the first is what's called the cranial vertebral joint, which of course represents the articulation between the vertebra and the occiput, right? So this is known as the atlanto-occipital joint. It is between C1 and the occiput. It is a condyloid synovial joint. The concave superior articular facets on the atlas articulate with the convex surfaces of the two occipital condyles. Yes? Okay? This permits flexion and extension. Yes. Okay? So we can see here in the green, here we can see the occipital condyles on the occiput here. And the green represents this articulation between the superior articulating surface of C1 and these occipital condyles on either side to make up the joint. We can kind of see it here as well. Again, they're synovial, so therefore all the things we can think about, you know, fibrous capsule, synovial lining, joint space, fluid, the whole bit, right? So we can see that it's right here. It's been cut away here, so you can see the joint here on either side, and it's represented here in the X-ray. You can see here the lovely spinous process of C2, and here we have, of course, no process in C1. You can see it up here as well in its articulation. See it a bit closer there, and then the joint there. I got lots of pictures in here that you can always come back to for sure. The second one is the atlantoaxial joint. Of course, that's between C1 and C2. We have the dens, or the odontoid process of C2, that's held within a collar formed by the anterior arch of C1 and the transverse ligament of the atlas. Now, because we have this dens sticking up in a compartment, it is a pivot joint. So it rotates when we say no. Okay? So this joint permits rotation saying no. Now, we still have zygapophyseal joints between them both as well, which permits rotation as well. So we have to think about that. You know, when we look at the dens in that rotation, we have to remember there still is superior articulating surfaces on C2 that articulate with inferior articulating surfaces on C1, and it further permits rotation. So think of all of C1, yes, it's spinning about the dens, but it's also sliding and gliding between the inferior articulating process of 1 and the superior articulating process of 2. Yes? Okay. So we can see it here. Here's our transverse ligament here holding the odontoid process in place. And you can see it here as well that you can see, right, we've got C2 here with the superior articulating surface here, articulating with the inferior articulating process of C1. So in so much as, yes, there is rotation between the dens and C1, C1 still needs to kind of slide on or about C2 here as well when it's happening. This is with it somewhat cut away. So we're looking at a sagittal view here. Here is the anterior arch here. Here is the dens of C2. And here is the transverse ligament right here. And you can see how it's encapsulated between the transverse ligament and the anterior arch. And it spins about within that compartment. Any questions on that? Okay. Nuchal ligament or ligamentum nuchae. Of course, we said already that it's a blending of the supraspinous and interspinous ligaments, and it runs from C7 to the occiput. So the ligamentum nuchae does not start until C7. So think of palpating that spinous process of C7 and then going all the way up and palpating the external occipital protuberance. That represents where the ligamentum nuchae starts and where it attaches. C7, spinous process of C7 to the external occipital protuberance of the occiput. And I believe you've probably palpated both at this point, yes? Okay. It resists hyperflexion of the cervical spine. So we have to think about, when we were talking about deep cervical anterior muscles the other day, whiplash. This gets sprained in whiplash. That if you get enough whip anteriorly into flexion, you can elongate this ligament and sprain it. In fact, a grade 3 whiplash can actually tear this, which is not very much fun, but it can very much be involved. So now, having learned longus coli and those sorts of muscles, someone comes to you with whiplash, you have to consider anterior structures, anterior to the cervical spine, coming through the anterior neck, and now posterior structures, such as ligamentum nuchae, are the affected within the context of that injury. No, it's not. I mean, if it was a full rupture, you probably wouldn't survive that kind of whiplash. It would be like a small sort of minor fiber tears, and you get associated inflammation and probably have to be in a neck collar to kind of give that area some relief until it healed a bit better. It's taught at extreme cervical flexion or at 15 degrees flexion of the head and the upper cervical spine. So if you have palpated this in lab, then you were told to verify that. Just have your patient bring their chin to their chest, and it should become very taut, right? Nice and tight, you'll feel it. You can see it here in the diagram. Again, this is a Netter drawing. That's why I love the book so much. They're very well painted and drawn out. So here's your ligamentum nuchae here. You can see it coming off of the spinous processes. Remember, ligamentum nuchae is made up of the interspinous ligaments and the supraspinous ligament. Now, the supraspinous ligament is still attaching to the tip of the spinous process of T1, and then, of course, the tips of all the way down to the lumbar area, but it somewhat breaks away at about C7, and then the supraspinous ligament does not touch the tip of an SP again, spinous process again, and get this whole area quite filled in with this ligamentous tissue, making that entire nuchal ligament, and remembering it runs up the middle, hence the reason why we generally have bifid spinous processes in the C-spine, so that the muscles can attach either from the right or the left because of that ligamentum nuchae being in the center. Okay, everybody understand that? All right. Now, this posterior longitudinal ligament that we talked about earlier today, we said it arises from the occiput, and it does. It runs from the occiput to the sacrum. When that ligament that runs from the occiput to the sacrum, when that we look at that ligament from C1, basically, to the sacrum, it is known as the posterior longitudinal ligament. that same ligament, when it gets up into and above the foramen magnum, it's the same ligament, but it has a new name. It's called the tectorial membrane. So it's the same ligament, but it has a different name above the foramen magnum. So it's continuation of the posterior longitudinal ligament superior to C2, and it becomes taut with flexion of the head, and of course it's not palpable, right? So we can see it here, it's been cut away. We can see it here as well, cut away. So it would be down here. Here's your posterior longitudinal ligament between C2, and we can see it's been deflected away and cut in this drawing, dissection drawing. We can see it here as well. Here's the posterior longitudinal ligament, still intact. And again, above C2, it is now called the tectorial membrane. And it comes right in to the inside anterior part of the occiput. So if you've got your skull, when you get home, literally come into that foramen magnum, so the face will be here and the occiput's back here. It actually runs into the occiput just behind the face. Comes all the way up and on. Okay? Actually, I can do that probably because I've got a cutaway here. So here's the foramen magnum here. So this ligament will come up and attach here where my finger is. Right, because there's the front of the face. So the ligament comes up and attaches here in the back of the ear, behind the face on the front part of the occiput, right where my finger is. Okay. Now, we have a whole bunch of movements that occur here. We have flexion extension, and we had rotation. So we have to allow those movements, but we have to have ligaments to support those movements and prevent those movements from going too far. So we have some ligaments all over the place, that some that are going to stop rotation and so forth. Our first one is called the cruciform ligament. It lies deep to the tectorial membrane. So where we just talked about the tectorial membrane coming on the occiput, deep to it is this cruciform ligament. It has vertical and transverse process. Cruciform means cross. So it means it's got fibers that go this direction and fibers that go this direction, just like a cross, okay? The vertical portion arises at C2 and attaches to the occiput, and the horizontal portion attaches on the interior surface of the occiput itself. So it attaches to the anterior surface of the ring of the atlas and reinforces the transverse ligament. So we can see it here. This is the... We've got the transverse ligament here. Here's the cruciform running up and down vertically and across this way. So we say that the vertical portion arises at C2 and attaches to the occiput, and the horizontal portion attaches to the interior surface of the anterior ring of the atlas and reinforces the transverse part here. So we have this vertical part here, and then we have a part that crosses this way. Okay? So we have this sort of this cross-like one. We can kind of see it here as well in the cadaver coming up this way. Here's our vertical part, and then we have our horizontal part here. You can see it here as well. They call it a cruciate, but cruciform, the same thing. The next is the transverse ligament of the atlas. It attaches on the interior surface of the anterior ring of the atlas, which we've talked about. It encloses the dens. It is lined with synovial membrane and provides lubrication as the atlas rotates around. So we had hyaline cartilage on the posterior aspect of the anterior tubercle, right? And we have a bit of synovial stuff on the transverse ligament. So because the den spins around within that compartment between the transverse ligament and the anterior tubercle, that we need this hyaline cartilage and synovial fluid and space and so forth for this den to dens to swing around and spin within that area. So we can see it here. Here we've got the anterior arch on its posterior aspect, but a hyaline cartilage here. We have synovial membrane and fluid and so forth here and here, which allows this to spin. The alar ligament. When we talk about alar, it's like the wings of an angel. Okay? I know it means wing. This is a wing-like configuration with attachments from the dens to the occiput at the lateral margins of the foramen magnum. This ligament checks excessive rotation and lateral flexion of the head, which would be otherwise allowed by this. So I always do it this way. So I'm the, my body's the dens. My arms are the alar ligament. So it checks rotation by the fact that it attaches out here on the margins of the of the foramen magnum. Okay. We can see it here is the alar ligaments here and here coming off either side, right off directly off the top of the dens. Here's your alar ligaments here as well. You can see the dens here, and it comes off either side near the tip of the dens. The next one is called the apical ligament, and that means this is a ligament that runs right from the top of the tip of the odontoid process and goes to the occiput. And it is right here, attaches right on the tip, and comes up here into the occiput. You can see it here as well in this diagram, right here. Now, those are specific ligaments that check movements and so forth. Surrounding this whole area, we still need something that holds the occiput to the spine. Because we've only been talking about these direct relationships between the pure articulations between the superior articulating surfaces of C1 and the occipital condyles and so forth. We still need more strength here. So we have something called the atlanto-occipital membranes. They extend from the anterior and posterior arches of C1 to the anterior and posterior margins of the foramen magnum. So when we look at C1 here, we're saying that this membrane runs from the anterior arch all the way up to the occiput and from the posterior arch all the way up to the occiput, thus surrounding the entire foramen magnum and the superior surface of C1 with this membrane all the way around. Make sense? Maybe coming all the way around and coming up and holding that occiput in place. Obviously not where there's the articulating parts are, but where the two arches are. It resists excessive movements of the atlanto-occipital joint. So we've cut it away here. We're looking from the posterior aspect anteriorly, and we can see how the anterior atlanto-occipital membrane is sort of here in the front, again between the anterior arch and the margins of foramen magnum. Here we have the same thing posteriorly. It arises from the posterior arch of the atlas and surrounds the foramen magnum posteriorly. Okay? All right. Sit back, relax. If you've got some popcorn, enjoy it.